Hallito, and welcome to Native Chalk Talk, a podcast by Natives for all. Here we're keeping our Native ancestors' stories and history alive, while also sharing with you our Native culture, traditions, and more. I'm Rachel Youngman, a Choctaw originally from Anadarko, Oklahoma. I hope you'll enjoy this journey with me as we learn from our Native American guests. And I hope you'll do me a favor. Feel free to like and share these episodes. I so appreciate it. Yakuki.
Hey, y'all, check out my new t-shirt. This is the Native Chalk Talk Missing Murdered Indigenous Women Chuta t-shirt. I've also got sweatshirts, cups, all kinds of things, and a portion of proceeds goes to support the cause. Simply go to cafepress.com/Native Chalk Talk shop, and we really appreciate all your support, and please pray for the families and the victims. Yakoki.
A Choctaw woman sat gazing out her nursing home window, soaking in the warmth of the sun that was making its way through the mimosa trees. Through her aging eyes, she glanced down at her brown and feeble fingers and hands as she crocheted yet more doilies. Perhaps these would be for the arms of her chair. These once young and strong hands had made baby blankets, hankies, clothing, and moccasins. They helped tend to her family's farm. They drove a team of horses hitched to a wagon. They held her beautiful baby boy. They clung to the United States flag as her veteran husband was laid into the earth. Her eyes saw grocery stores replacing her family's vegetable stand. She saw the wagons being replaced by cars, and she watched as her baby boy grew into a war hero, the papers singing his praises, something that had never happened to anyone in her native community. These hands and these eyes had experienced pivotal moments in history, and yet here she sat in this nursing home, the last home in which she would ever live. Did anyone care to hear this history and these precious memories? She guessed they surely wouldn't be interesting to anyone. Little did she know these stories were interesting and someone out there would certainly care to hear them, but only after she was gone. I hear all too often, why didn't I ask more questions of my family members when they were still with us? Now their history and memories and stories are gone forever. I too am one of those with deep regrets. I should have asked and I should have listened more. But it's not too late for some of you listeners out there. You may have family members still living who would be willing to sit down with you and share their memories. You may have to twist their arms a bit, but trust me, the effort will be worth it. Set up the recorder or take video on your phone or write it all down or whatever you have to do, but please do try to capture these stories. My guest today is one such person who took time to do so, and I'm so grateful that he did, because today he is going to share with us the beautiful stories of his ancestors. Stanford, welcome to Native Chalk Talk, and thank you for taking time to share with us today.
Thank you.
Absolutely. So I'll start off by bragging on you just a bit. Stanford is originally from Kayenta Black Mesa on the Navajo Reservation. He received his engineering degree from Northern Arizona University and has worked in the architecture, engineering, and construction field for the last 20 years. His experience includes projects for indigenous tribes, professional architects and engineers, general contractors, government officials, and private owners. Stanford has received multiple awards and honors, such as the AIA SES Sequoia Fellow, issued by the American Indian Science and Engineering Society, where he also holds a lifetime professional membership. The 2018 Governor's James W. Garrison Heritage Award, issued by the Arizona Preservation Foundation and the State Historic Preservation Office. In addition, in 2012, he received the 40 Under 40 Award from the National Center for American Indian Enterprise Development, recognizing Native American citizens for outstanding leadership and community contributions annually. Stanford was also a team member for honorees for the restoration work on the historic Navajo Nation Council building in Window Rock, Arizona. Stanford, way to make your nation proud in the field of engineering and beyond. Why don't you tell us about your world growing up on the Navajo Reservation?
All right. Thank you, Rachel, again. My name is Stanford Lake. In the Navajo culture, the most important thing we start off with is our our kinship of what clan we represent in our communities and also on the Navajo Nation. So let me introduce myself. Yate She Stamper Lake and Chia. Tlizathan Shlon, Puritini Bashistin, Kia Ani Dashiche, Tohane Dashinada, Totinez Jede is in Asha, Dodgilijin, Dodd in Asha. But I denunce, I behind this dog, I denunce the dog, Prescott, Arizona, easy auto. So I'm the nationalization ad here. I just introduced myself in my Navajo, the Nepizad, which means Navajo language. And it's important to express my introduction as my clanship. As a Navajo, you have like a four clans that you present yourself to the elders, especially so that they know who you represent and also where your community is located at. So that's how I introduce myself. And I mentioned the Diné means the people in the Navajo language. For Anglo language, it's called Navajo. I mentioned, I grew up in Kienta, Arizona. And on weekends, I would spend my time with my siblings and my parents up on Black Mesa, Arizona, which is located probably 30 minutes south of Kienta, Arizona. So, and again, Kienta, Arizona really was just growing up near the school system, public school system of the Kienta Unified School District. So I went to school from there when I was in kindergarten through 12th grade in high school. So when I turned 18, always dreaming about going to college as a first generation. Both my parents both did go to college, but they never completed to get their degree, but they always encouraged me and my siblings to go to school or go to trade school, whatever, so that we can be able to function in today's society. So thank you.
Wow, that it sounds like they really instilled in you to not only take the torch that they started, but to continue on forward and into completion. And I'm really excited about the things that you've done. I mean, engineering is not an easy field. So you went all in, you took their advice and did not slow down, and you kept on going and you're still going. You must be proud. So it sounds like you also lived a pretty traditional way of life. Tell us about that.
The traditional way of life starts with the, I guess, more of just instill of everyday life on the Navajo reservation, meaning planting corn and attending to our corn fields during the, starting from the spring and then through harvest season, which is the fall season. So we did pretty much every single year, we would do that with both my parents and also my grandparents. And a lot of teaching was presented during that time. After a long day in the cornfield, we would probably get one of the watermelons or just have a barbecue to celebrate the hard work in the hot summer. And in that time, either my grandparents or my dad or mom would tell stories to us about how they grew up during when they were younger. And then my grandparents would talk about how they also worked in the cornfields and how that was taught to them from their parents and grandparents. And so it's actually a tradition, and there's a lot of ties of our tradition, like the cornfield I mentioned. It's also instilled inside of our sacred songs, and just as a traditional person growing up in the Navajo religion. We went to a lot of summer ceremonies and also the winter ceremonies. And some of it's called Nda, which meant the enemy way. And also during the winter, there's the Yebichi. We call it the Hajong life, to be in balance with nature and also in balance with a lot of different elements that we, as we go through life and stuff like that. So when we go out of balance, that's when we would seek a local medicine man or medicine woman that will keep, put us back into harmony, we call it. We cleanse ourselves, our soul, our mind, just a lot of things so that we were back in balance. There's a lot of teaching through the cornfield, like the harvesting.
I was just going to say, it's interesting that the harvesting is one of the most important things that you brought up right away, and the corn and all of that. And it goes back, it sounds like generations and generations of the way that you're doing corn. Is it just internal for your people to eat the corn, or is it sold outside of the tribe?
Actually, it's more of, besides the corn, there's also like watermelons, squash, and beans, and just potatoes. Those are what I meant by the cornfield, those different type of vegetables,
okay.
And
yeah.
things that are harvested or planted and harvested and stuff like that. So those are really important things that my ancestors were able to use that when there was no grocery stores and
right.
things like that, that they would depend on not only that, but also hunting, stuff like that, games, wild turkeys. I think the most important thing also in the culture is sheep. Sheep is sort of a traditional food, and there's a lot of things associated with sheep.
Mm-hmm.
And they also, you know, you take care of your sheep and it takes care of you back through food that we eat from that. So if you, with us Navajos, we have really enjoy having our mutton food in the traditional way through the stew or dried meat. We also bring in like the steamed corn that's been harvested from the cornfield.
Wonderful. I mean, it sounds pretty healthy living off the land out there. Can you think of ways that, say, the corn, for instance, is grown today from the generations of the perfection from your people over the years? Is it different than the way maybe a typical farmer would farm their corn?
When I grew up, we had access to tractors. So my dad did have a tractor, and we were able to use that to harvest. Before that, my grandparents would say they didn't have that luxury of that. They would use a mule or a horse and pull like a plow, like a single plow, and use that to plant corn and the different things. And they mentioned the generations before them, their grandparents beyond, they didn't have those tools. So they would probably use a branch off of a tree and use that to put a hole in the ground and plant the seeds and stuff like that. And all these, and also another important thing about the cornfield is the seeds, those are passed on from generation to generation. So they're kept in storage, so for the next season and stuff like that.
Amazing. Wonder how far back that goes.
That's interesting. I have read a few things about some traditional farmers, not only the Navajos, but the Hopis, that the seed is sort of a generation thing that is important. So,
as you know, Native Chalk Talk is all about preservation, capturing our native stories and history and culture. And as mentioned, when we're younger, though, we don't think to ask our elders questions about their own stories and lives. However, you had some interesting talks with your mother and your grandmother, correct?
The stories that was instilled in me was more of maybe in the winter time when we're eating at a dinner table, they would always bring up in the old time, they would always talk about the old time, about how they grew up, or even stories like the coyote stories, which has a lot of, he's considered the trickster in the Navajo culture. So, but in the story, it instills like good information of not what to do, and what there's a meaning behind each of these stories and stuff like that. The Navajo culture, that a lot of it's passed through just storytelling, and it's not like it wasn't recorded or anything, and it was just passed on from generation to generation. And it's just something that now with technologies we're able to capture a lot of this before it's gone stuff. I know in the Navajo culture there's a lot of like I mentioned earlier, we're in balance with a lot of different elements. And to keep in balance, there's also taboos in the Navajo culture that if you do something bad, sort of come back and the medicine man, or else you have your own family do prayers over you to help you get back in balance and stuff like that. So,
well, and speaking of medicine men or medicine women, you have one in your family, and we're going to talk about her later, which I think is fascinating. And I do wonder sometimes how the stories change over the centuries. Like, you know, how far off have they gotten, like a telephone game? But that's even part of the mystique and the coolness about it as well, don't you think?
Yeah, that's correct.
So in those talks, you also learned about an ancestor that was a code talker. So you have to tell us about this. This is so fascinating.
Yeah. I think when growing up, again, in the early 80s, when I was younger, my dad would always have these stories about his maternal uncle, which means my maternal grandmother's younger brother. His name was Carlos Begay. He was the only male in the family of sisters.
Oh. Yeah.
So he grew up in among the Bitterwater clan, which was his clan also. And he was originally from Black Mesa area, Arizona also. And the way that my dad talked about, because he was one of the close members to him when he came back from World War II, he mentioned that when he was 16, he wanted to go to a place where he never has been before. All he did was herd sheep most of his life, and he told his grandfather that take me to Fort Wingate, New Mexico. And he was only 16 at the time, so this great-grandfather took him to Fort Wingate by wagon. Back in the day, they had wagons with mule, and that was their transportation to go from Black Mesa to Fort Wingate, New Mexico. It probably takes like 2 to 3 days on with the wagon and stuff like that. So when he got there, he pretended that he was 18, and that was the only way that he would be able to volunteer in the U.S. Marine Corps. So his grandfather, with him witnessing that he signed and decided to volunteer and enlist in the U.S. Marine, because at the time they were recruiting, they were in need of the Navajo male. World War II was going on, and it was one of the ways to besides to volunteer, but also have a job. So that was one reason why he volunteered. And he volunteered probably somewhere in the early 1940s, based on my dad's record for recollection of what he was told to him. And so from Fort Wingate, he was transferred to Camp Pendleton in California. And he went through a special, I guess he went through boot camp first, and then afterwards he was told that he's going to go under a special program project called the I guess at the time maybe it was called Navajo Code Talking School. Mm-hmm. And some of the words that he remembers, my dad remembers, it was like bird, city, which means airplane. Another word would be like city BAG, which means bird's eggs, which means bomb. I guess this one really was, another one would be like shush, which means bear in the Navajo language, which means there's an attack coming. So words like that he remembers being told to him, and then he would share that stories about that to us when we were younger. And this is the early 1980s when he was telling me and my siblings, but there's a time when the Navajo Code Talker was still unknown, just mm-hmm. maybe just to the family members of all these Navajo Code Talkers shared stories like that. So, and then from Camp Clinton, when he went to the Navajo Code Talker School, he completed that. And then he went with the, maybe they call it platoon or division, across to the Pacific, across the Pacific Ocean to an island called Iwo Jima. So in that Iwo Jima, I guess he was also in the same group as Ira Hayes, or Gila River Indian community member that was famous for raising the flag on Iwo Jima. So one of the things that my dad shared was that him being in the same group as Ira Hayes, there was that right before the flag was being raised, I guess in that small group, they needed some volunteers to go up to this mountain and present this flag up on this mountain and stuff like that. And he said there was no one wanting to volunteer, and everyone was really afraid because there was a lot of ammunition and things
thought about that.
So a lot of the men were scared and stuff like that. But, and even my, I guess you'd call it grandpa, Carlos Begay, was afraid and stuff like that. But I guess all of a sudden his good friend Ira Hayes said, I'll volunteer, even though he was afraid to go out there to this mountain. So he did his duty to raise his flag with four other people, and then raised his flag up and became famous and stuff like that. So he mentioned that after the war, when he came home, there was really no welcome ceremonies or things like that, because it was just this special project that was, and they were told to keep it a secret.
And no one knew.
And it wasn't declassified until years later. I think maybe in the 60s or 70s, I can't recall, but sometime during that. But I think my dad said he was a good uncle, but also a lot of mental health problems after the war. He did a lot of heavy drinking coming when he got home and stuff like that. But he never recovered from that, and just passed on back in the 1970s. So
fascinating. Is there anything else you can think of about that time frame or your family members?
In World War II era, our own elders, Navajos, a lot of them started working for the areas Belmont, where they were making ammunition and bombs,
right,
to help support the wars and stuff like that. So a lot of them were recruited in that direction. And then a lot of them also were recruited to work in the uranium mines, because that the U.S. discovered that uranium can be used as a nuclear weapon, and I believe that's one of the things that helped stop the war, was was dropping two nuclear bombs in Japan. So would that happen? Or some of our Navajo people were also working in the uranium mines to help support the wars and stuff like that.
Interesting. So I know that there's been a lot of controversy over the years, and I think that there should be no judgment either way with how people feel about it. But some people are like, well, our Native people shouldn't have fought for this country. And yet I know so many veterans, Native veterans, who are extremely proud to have fought for this country. But it sounds like there are some Navajo that believe in fighting for our country.
Oh, yeah, it's definitely true. They're considered warriors in our culture, and they're really, when I go to different ceremonies, both in the traditional way and also the Native American church, they're always the one that are told to rise and get blessed, and because they're honorary, considered defending our Nawstong, which means Mother Earth. A lot of honor and just a lot of things that just to help us protect us from our freedom, I guess you can call it. So,
thank you, veterans. How do you say thank you in Navajo?
Ahehe.
Veterans. Sorry. Apologies to all Navajo. Tell me about your parents, Alice and Joe, right?
Yeah. Well, my mother, her name is Alice Cly, her maiden name. She grew up in northwest of Kiente area, up in the canyons. Went to boarding school in Kiente, Arizona, and then in high school, she went to the Phoenix Indian school up in Phoenix, Arizona. So she told me that that she worked odd jobs while going to high school because there wasn't enough money coming from home. So she had to sort of support herself through high school by working at maybe a sewing machine shop or some downtown Phoenix. Mm-hmm. So that's how she went through high school. And then from high school, she went back to Kiente. She got hired as a boarding school aide, I guess you can call it dorm aide, at the local Kiente EIA boarding school. So she did that for 40 plus years, and maybe like 6 years ago she retired from there, and now she's doing that. And then my father, he grew up on Black Mesa area, also in the traditional way of like herding sheep and just doing the normal as a traditional. And he went to different, we call it boarding school. He mentioned he went to Chinle, and he told me a story one time when he first went to Chinle. Him and a group of relatives from Black Mesa decided one night to run away from the boarding school and went back. Maybe took him maybe 50 miles to get back from Chinle to Black Mesa area. So just because he thought that he wanted to come home and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So
was it because of a bad experience, you think, or he was just homesick, or both?
Maybe just homesick and stuff like that. Maybe not used to the new education system at the time. And this would be probably in the 1960s that he was.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting that there's a space in time where, you know, our ancestors had to go from a certain way of living to changing that way of living. And so there's two generations that, you know, let's say a grandma and grandpa and their grandkids, or however far the generation gap is, where it's like, well, we used to live in huts or teepees or grass huts or whatever the case is, and now you're living in wooden or brick homes, or, you know, things like that, where we didn't really go to school. We tended to the sheep. And now my kids are going to an actual school and they're learning certain things. They're learning math. And it had to have been such a strange disconnect between those different generations especially grandparents. I feel like with the Navajo, though, it feels like they held on, you all held on to your traditions and culture a lot stronger than maybe some other tribes were able to do. Do you agree with that?
I agree in a sense that kept our tradition alive and our language, but I know since maybe the turn of the century, 2000, it's has been where technology has grown.
Yeah, enough, where, right.
we're now living in a time where our youth, our Navajo youth, are accustomed to these technologies and have little knowledge about our previous traditional life that I was brought up in. My parents were brought up in. So, but I think also technology can be also be good, meaning it could help preserve some of these cultures, help teach the Dene language using apps and different things, or through YouTube, or someone can archive a lot of these our native language through it so that it's not lost or something. You know?
Much agreed. Obviously, that's why I have a podcast. And I'm seeing more and more elders kind of agreeing and being open to that. I can see why it's a scary thought, but I'm hoping that it just keeps things alive and going and all that.
We'll be back after this quick break. Are you looking for the perfect gift for your significant other, your bestie, or even yourself? You know you're worth it. Luxury soaps, lotions, and lip balms from Baker's Bar Soapery are 100% Choctaw crafted, and they make the perfect gifts. This work of art is their signature turquoise soap, and it's made to look like Sleeping Beauty turquoise. Do you see this gold veining throughout? And the gold marbling on top? Love it. Next, check out this Apple Mint custom fragrance oil soap called Say Their Name. And all proceeds go to the Missing Murdered Indigenous Women Choctaw cause. You'll only find this blend made specifically for this soap. And yes, these are made with goat's milk, which leaves your skin feeling soft and supple. So load up on these Choctaw soaps made by Tiffany at Baker's Bar Soapery at thebbsoapery.com. But be sure to get 20% off when you use the code NATIVECHOCTALK, that's all caps, when you spend $25 or more. Treat yourself to the luxury your skin deserves with Baker's Bar Soapery.
Now, your parents, they married in a real traditional way, correct?
That's correct.
What does that look like, a Navajo marriage?
Yeah. So the traditional way of, I guess that you can say from my parents' generation and beyond before that was, they call it arranged marriage, meaning the groom, and when he's considered up as an adult enough to take care of himself, then the parents or the grandparents of his family would go in the distance and find another family that's not related in clans, and ask if they have a young woman that would be a possible bride to this groom and stuff like that. So they would request that there's one. And so in my parents' situation, my dad's parents went into the Kayenta area and asked some families in the area if they had a bride for their son, and they came across my grandparents' home in Narrow Canyon and decided to create this arrangement of marriage.
And had they met them before?
They never met before.
Wow.
So they only, I guess they met on the day of their wedding. So
no way.
So that's the traditional way of many generations ago. That's how they were.
It sounds like it worked. They're still.
It worked. I mean, in the tradition, when they okay the arranged marriage, then the groom with the family would supply like sheep, horses or cows, and also now jewelries, shashbelt, which is considered wealth by the Navajo culture. And they would present that to the bride's family as a gift.
What about the cases? I've always wondered in these arranged marriages where they give gifts and that kind of thing, or dowries, however you want to call it. What do they do in the cases when maybe they don't have a lot and they don't have goats to give or whatever the case?
I believe back in the day, there was a lot more wealth of sheep and things like that every family had on the Navajo.
They made it work.
It worked and stuff. But now that the land is dry, and not saying that the Navajo arranged marriage still happens. I don't know if it still happens, but because of the reduction in livestock now. A lot of the traditional Navajo weddings are now where it's this exchange of money, and besides jewelries now, if the family doesn't own livestock or something like that.
So your parents were going through that arranged marriage, and prior to that, you know, that's how people got married. But after that, so it sounds like from what you're saying today, even if it's jewelry today or money, because there's not sheep, sounds like people are still getting married in that way in the Navajo culture, correct?
That's correct. It's just based on each family. I mean, now families, they have both the traditional way and also in their other religion would be the church and stuff, church wedding.
Yeah.
Just only the church and stuff like that. So.
Yeah. And there might be different clans maybe that practice different methods. Some are more, I don't want to use the word primitive, but more traditional.
Each clans, each region of the Navajo Nation has different, their own custom ways of doing these traditional ceremonies, traditional weddings and stuff like that. So it's just up to the bride's family, the way they want to do the wedding ceremony.
I love that that's still going on. And again, I feel like it's kind of a rarity these days.
But I know that, I'm sure the arranged marriage is in the past. It's not something that now you have our younger generations that now meet at colleges
they're bringing home the person they want to marry.
Correct.
So when after marriage takes place, where do the bride and groom go, or where did they go? Did they stay with the parents of the bride or the parents of the groom? I mean, because again, they could be two different clans or.
Yeah, there'd be two different, there are two different clans, but usually the custom is the groom would stay with the bride's family because he's now considered a family member, a male figure in that family. So he has a lot of responsibilities now to the family.
Yeah.
And whatever he was taught, he would bring to that family. Like I said, maybe he worked in the cornfield or he raised livestock or sheep herd. So he's able to do some of those duties and stuff like that.
Yeah, bring some value to the family. Correct. And all that. And so I know that you've sent me a photo of one of your relatives. I can't remember if it's your dad or grandpa standing in front of a clay looking home. Can you describe what their dwellings tended to look like and maybe even look like today?
Okay. Yeah. You're talking about the traditional hogan, we call it.
Hogan. Yes. Hogan.
So it's an 8-sided structure. The traditional structure back maybe from early 1900s to and before that, they use the local wood materials around, and they built this hut and covered it with dirt clay and stuff like that. And they kept that way. They kept it was well insulated, and the cold never got in. And during the summer, they would wet the floors, and that would help cool the inside area all day and stuff like that.
Yes.
So it's really, to me, I always consider that they knew about green building, that this was a traditional dwelling hut that the family would use year round and stuff like that too, as a place that they brought up their families and had the traditional ceremonies inside of it and things like that.
Well, in that case, they probably were not nomadic, correct?
They weren't nomadic, meaning before the 1900s, though, before the Navajo, I guess 1930s, before the tribal government came into play, a lot of the Navajos can use the season in the wherever the wild animal wild games were at. They would move around from different areas to different areas, and
makes sense.
Also, the sheep had, there's always the winter camp and the summer camps, where the these different locations that they use and stuff. And so the traditional hogan was more of a place for ceremonies and stuff like that. And so these different Navajos would come to
really
and do their ceremonies, but most of the times they would be in cha'o, which means traditionally a shade house. So they would use that as a way of moving around different regions, because of the sheep might need grazing at certain places, or what their water holes might be certain places.
Right. When you were talking about making sure that the floors were watered to keep it cool in there, I was thinking about Waylon Thompson, who is, he's one of my previous guests, and I did a sweat at his house with his family and some other people. And one of the ladies that was there said that she would do sweats with the Navajo. I think she's part Navajo, but in Arizona in the summer. And I was like, that must be so hard. And I realize, as someone who doesn't do a lot of sweats, that seems impossible to me, but to someone who does it all the time, I'm sure it's not that big of a deal. But it has to get really hot out there in the summer, much less with the sweats, right?
And that's correct. So again, the hogan really was really tightly insulated structure, really had huge thermal mass, so a lot of the weather never got cold or hot during the summer inside this traditional dwelling.
Amazing.
Stuff like that. So I think one thing you touched about too, sweat. So we have this miniature type hogan dwelling that our traditional people use. We call it the sweat house. This structure is where they would build a fire and then put the hot stones inside this hut and stuff, and then they would sweat. It was mainly to purify themselves, to have to be in the Hajjunk way, a good balance again. So another way to balance yourself through the sweat and stuff like that.
Wonderful. I mean, I'll...
Oh, yeah. And I forgot it. The meaning behind that structure is called Hache.
Hache.
Correct.
Okay. Yeah, a lot of folks don't know a lot about sweat lodges. They may hear about it. I know that a lot of people that are non-native have picked it up over the years. So it's become this kind of commercialized scenario for some people trying to find spirituality. But to our Native American people, it is kind of part of the fabric of their lives, you know, especially those that, such as yourself, I assume, who has grown up very traditional. So thanks for sharing a bit about that as well. So what can you tell us about your dad's side, your dad's mother?
My dad's mother, her name in the Navajo language is called Sun Lake, meaning the Lady Lake, I guess you call it. That's how her name is spelled on envelopes and mail or just things.
Right.
Yes. So anyways, so she had a young, maybe a younger sister, a twin sister, and her name was Ed Lake, Girl Lake. So she was the Lady Lake, and then her twin sister was the Girl Lake, so younger.
Aww.
So there, but she, her, I guess her twin sister passed away in maybe about 4 or 5 years ago. But Aww. So, but anyways, she actually grew up in the traditional way of the Navajo, also did a lot of doing cornfields also, like I mentioned, and also tending to her sheep a lot. The sheep was really, it was like another relative to her, like it was important to her to be around her sheep all the time.
Interesting.
So she herd sheep all her life until she maybe reached 80 years old.
Are you serious?
She wasn't able to see anymore. That's one thing that she wasn't able to do. So, and then her health was sort of failing, but mainly it was her eyesight. So, and then I guess she started to lose a little bit of her memory, and the family decided to put her in a nursing home in Chinle, Arizona. She's going to be about 104 years old this month. So she's.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Stan, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Someone who's 104 years old has so much of a lifetime of seeing things change over the years. I mean, what's her story? What was she like? Do you know much about her history?
One thing she had was that she was constantly just working all the time. She was
no wonder she's lived so long, because she's probably healthy.
She cooked a lot of the traditional food. She knew a lot of these traditional food that not a lot of the Navajos know or no longer use, but she was able to use the corn in these different ways of using the corn husk, a way to wrap them and put it in sort of like a covered ground fireplace, and she would do these traditional food. And
so ways good.
That is really, not, like I said, not a lot of people still do it. Like another thing would be like the corn mush or the red berry mush, which is just different, really different things that she did that I remember. So
please tell me someone has captured her, I guess, so-called recipes.
Yeah, I don't know if anyone captured that, but I just remember memories about this good food that I used to eat from her kitchen.
So she was born around 1919-ish.
1920, right? Based on records that I saw on ancestors.com.
Yeah.
And just
amazing.
And just did a lot of other stuff, like, but mainly just I saw her cooking a lot for guests that came to her home, family members.
Aww.
And just really hardworking lady that just, when she's around other people, she sort of been like a shy person. But to the immediate family, she's a really strong person that everyone saw. So you don't mess with your grandma.
That's right. No, you don't. No, sir. So did she speak English or?
No, she never went to school, and all she knows is the Nepizod Navajo language. So everything around her. One thing I told my kids was, to see the outside world, go beyond what I've gone through and your mom went through. So the way I always interpret it is that the grandma, this Maui lady I had, the only thing she's around is maybe within the 10-mile radius or maybe 20-mile radius. That's all she saw, and that's all she's
That's amazing.
And herding sheep and stuff. And then the next generation, which is my parents, they're probably only within the 250-mile radius, like into the border towns. Is sometimes they go into those areas, but that's, and then they come home and take care of their livestock and stuff. And then myself and my wife's generation were beyond that.
Right.
6 hours away from where I grew up in Black Mesa, so it's sort of like larger radius, a 500 radius. I like to travel too, and I tell my kids, travel beyond the United States, see other cultures.
So true.
That's how I always interpret it. So when I bring up that, I always think about my grandmother that's only able to see so much. But I think in her time, she's able to see the changes from the grandkids and my parents but she never was able to go beyond that, but she's just able to be,
it's kind of neat though, isn't it, to think that someone has lived in that kind of a bubble all their lives. It's all they know, and they don't even speak an outside language. Do your kids speak Navajo as well?
No, they don't speak Navajo, but they do understand a few words that I sometimes exchange conversation with my wife, right? So they're able to pick up some certain things.
Well,
I think it was really mainly because we're away from their Navajo nation,
exactly,
Navajo reservation. So
right, they're not around it every day like you were growing up and your wife and everything. Just think of how their generation to your generation, you know, were you first language Navajo speaker?
Yes, my first language is Navajo.
And that's rare too for someone of your age. And so, and again, that brings me back to the whole Navajo kind of preservation of your culture and your language and all that beyond what I see in a lot of other tribes. But how interesting that their grandmother doesn't speak English, you're bilingual, at least bilingual, maybe trilingual, I don't know, and then they only speak English. And that's how fast something can change culture and language wise. Interesting. So the Navajo language, to me, there's a lot of chish sounds and kind of like the keeping your teeth together formations in the mouth. I'm very interested in the different tribal languages and all that. To me, it sounds so far from, say, just a few states over, like you, my Choctaw people in Mississippi, seems very different in the sound. Do you know much about the background of the language?
I know a little bit about the background. Well, I guess in the traditional way of our culture, our religion, our ceremonies, the Navajo language was given to us from the holy people within our language. We're in the fourth world, so that's the way the teaching has it. But yeah, I guess if you go into the, say, ancestor.com or other ways that you're researching about this language, it's actually a language that there's also, they call it sister tribes that speak similar language, but their dialogue is different, or there's different. It's sort of like the Apache, White Mountain Apaches. I've been invited to some events there in the past, and to sit there with the elders and the people there, I can pick up a few things what they're saying in their
It's amazing, lines. Really.
It's similar dialogue, but I believe that it's sort of like a family branch. I believe I can't remember the term, but it's a language that goes up into the Northern California area and up into the Canada and to the Alaska region, where some of these sister companies have similar dialogues, but has changed maybe over time. So
that's just amazing to me, because it makes you wonder. I mean, a person who has studied the languages would know better than I, but it makes you think, okay, what if at one time there was one people, and then for a long time there were only, say, three tribes, and then there were hundreds and hundreds from there, and so that's why there's so many similarities among some of our different tribal languages. So fascinating.
Yeah. So, but I know that like I mentioned, the Apache tribes have similar dialogues. But if I went into the Hopi Nation or the Zuni Nation or any of the Pueblos or even the South Indian tribes down in Phoenix to Tucson area, they totally speak different
Are you
language.
Serious?
So there's,
that's crazy.
It's and just different, really different. So just have to, I guess, spend time with them to be able to understand.
Oh yeah. Things.
But it's just, I mean, all tribes has their own language, and also even the Navajos of the Arizona side, the Western Navajos and also the Eastern Navajos, some of them had different dialogues, and there's sometimes some words are expressed differently than between the two locations and stuff like that. So
that's so interesting.
Maybe they were influenced by other tribes or the Spaniards at the time,
right?
Early 1900s. Yeah,
so true. And then, so when you do speak to someone with an Eastern dialect, for instance, just making that up, can you understand what they're saying for the most part? You're just missing certain words.
I can understand 80 to 90% of it.
Yeah.
There's some words that are differently said differently. I know one word is coffee, and I know in the Western we call it ahue. I believe over there it's called gohue. I believe that's gohue. Gohue, and the Western is called ahue. Or different region is just different.
That's just so interesting.
Yeah.
When you heard Coach James Nels, who I think he was in season 2 of Native Chalk Talk, when you heard him speaking in his language, did you understand what he was saying?
Yeah, I understand pretty much all of his talks because
so you guys must be around from kind of the same area.
No, he in his talks he said he grew up in the Dalcon region, was the southwestern of the Navajo Nation, which is actually also where my wife grew up in the same area.
I know this is a stupid question, but I wonder if they knew each other.
I don't know. Sounds like Coach Nels, when he went to college, when he came back, he moved straight to Riverside Indian School. So he's been only came home when there's ceremonies and stuff like that. So
I gotcha. You know, he talked about too, so I kind of wanted to ask you about this, how there would be people all sleeping in their home and he could hear people talking, you know, telling stories at night or just talking at night, and then he'd fall asleep. It was kind of a comfort feeling. How many people could fit in one of those homes? And then do you remember, you know, memories like that as well?
The way my parents brought us up, we were able to live, me and my siblings, the younger sister and 2 younger brothers, I'm the oldest, and then my parents, we always lived in a home in Kianta, Arizona also, and a traditional hogan on Black Mesa, so we're able to be situated where we weren't living together with other relatives, because I think both my parents were able to work and just kept.
So it was just your immediate family, basically.
So the way that Coach James mentioned Nels is some of our people also have generation of family members from the grandparents down to their kids and grandkids that live in the same home, just because it's both affordable in a way, the only way that they're able to make a home and stuff like that, especially on the reservation, that's the way it is.
Absolutely.
I know through my work, engineering work and working with the different departments on the Navajo Nation, the main thing that's hard to get on the reservation is called home site lease, which is a 100-year lease given a 1-acre where you're given from the Navajo Nation, and once you're granted that, you're able to build your home or move a home onto that property. So,
so
it's one of those things where it's really complicated to get that lease. So what happens most of the time is that grandparents might be able to invite the grandkids or the family members to live with them, because
that does sound complicated and unlike what I had thought. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Stay tuned for part two coming up. Thanks for listening to Native Chalk Talk. Be sure to join our community on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And check us out at nativechalktalk.com. Stay tuned for the next episode. You're going to love it. Yuk-uk-ki. Thank you, my friends.